This is Angle of View. Today is June 16th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. Let's talk about some new releases. I suspended coverage of new releases on this show a few months ago when a huge life change started robbing me of my movie-going time, but I have snuck in a few here and there, and those few have now added up to a show. Some of these have been under hot discussion in the culture for weeks now, and I don't want to be left out of that discussion forever. Let's start out with a nice leisurely walk inside the one that has already found its way into the record books by having the youngest director of any movie that has ever gone number one at the domestic box office. Backrooms is, happily, pretty good, especially for an A24 horror movie by a 20-year-old first-time director adapted from his COVID-era web series. If you're unfamiliar with the Backrooms web series, which I must admit I am, except by reputation, maybe you'll enjoy getting the origin story in digest. It began as a single photograph posted to 4chan in 2011 of an emptied-out Wisconsin hobby shop that I suggest you look up because virtually everyone who has ever seen it has agreed that it is the creepiest empty room ever captured in a frame. Between the fluorescent overheads, the lack of windows, the vilely yellow wallpaper, and the suggestive angle of the photograph, it looks like an anonymous underground office space that goes on and on into infinite jaundice. So inspirationally hideous was this photo that after its big moment of discovery on the platform in 2019, it gave rise to some creepypasta lore, in the vein of Mark Z. Danielewski's infamously form-breaking horror novel House of Leaves, about an extra-dimensional structure accessible by no-clipping out of reality, a term borrowed from video games which refers to the glitching that can send your guy outside the designated map and into the negative space of the game. If you've heard the term liminal space over the past 5 years in conjunction with photos of empty sealed interiors that don't look quite right, you have been adjacent to the Backrooms. The lore branched, as such things do online, and different writers began imagining and detailing different rooms, which they called levels, spotlighting the video game connection again, and different antagonistic creatures that the various levels might hold, which they called entities, and not bosses for some reason. It became a new haunted house legend, which, because of the way it taunted the culture's concept of commercial space, came with a postmodern twist that gave it extra traction. Then in 2022, a high schooler named Kane Parsons began using Blender, a popular open-source animation program, to draw an extensive backrooms map and simulate a VHS core found footage horror story over top of it, condensing and arranging the foregoing creepypasta material, merging its liminal video game aesthetic with that of the technological era that precedes the artist. Parsons was born in 2005 and so is fascinated by the 1980s and 90s, and focusing the elements into something like a narrative, which clicked a little more firmly into place with each successive episode. That web series was the gathering up of all the Backrooms strands into one spindle, and it conferred onto Parsons the authority of its authorship, much in the same way, if you'll permit the least modest comparison available, that the codification of the Iliad did for Homer. Described this way, the Backrooms phenomenon sounds like a cool and successful self-contained art project slash internet curio that neither warrants nor wants the A24 feature film treatment. But in this case, and not least because A24 kept Parsons at the helm, Backrooms has taken the treatment pretty well. The movie is at its worst when it gets into its psychotherapy groove, the new and conventionally movie-like thing constructed by the movie's screenwriter Will Sudyk is two main characters who just happen to be a frustrated man and his therapist, and both characters' traumas and coping mechanisms unfortunately come to stand for a lot of things. But when the sixth space is just allowed to breathe, it's really marvelous, and fortunately there is enough of that. It was definitely more awful than I was expecting, which of course is a compliment. Few major movies that I've seen have managed this kind of spatial nausea, and the forwardness of the cultural cachet of the spaces is the worst part. This is precisely the right hauntology flavor for the American neoliberal hangover, the cursed reflection of the monstrously blank things we built at the height of our powers. And this is the mythic material that the film works well and effortlessly compared to the tormented psych stuff. The strip mall exterior that serves as our portal is the perfect facade for these hideous yellow guts, as though designed for them deliberately. I feel foolish for not having watched the web series, as I would love to have been able to see exactly what leap was made here, but I am willing to bet the web series did not have sets with this kind of painstakingly deranged horribleness. The irrational lines, the mutant furniture in the frontmost rooms giving way to mutant fixtures deeper in, followed by the discovery that a little deeper still, there are kinds of people in there. I'm also willing to bet that a lot of the features of these sets are CGI, even if just for the sake of loyalty to the aesthetic of the web series, and or to extend the visual connection to video games. Parsons has said that his single biggest inspiration for the visual design of the Backrooms movie was Portal 2, and of course it's cheaper to design these things in a computer program than to actually build them. But I was still in awe at the thoughtfulness of the design. It's almost unbelievable how many uniquely terrifying rooms you see for just a second or two. The uncanny, scraping terror of those rooms is the movie, so many hundreds of times more effective than the trite fluff about the therapist character, Renata Reinsva, having grown up with a crazy mom who trapped her in the house, or why her client, Chiwetel Ejiofor, the owner of the furniture store that is the portal, is trapped in a professional rut, however sensible thematically both character setups are for a story about a liminal space. Thank God they don't trot out an overbaked explanation for everything at the end, which would have dismissed the rooms from your future nightmares. I usually lodge the opposite complaint, but I think this movie could have stood to have less story. More ordinary people than these could have wandered into these same rooms and been consumed, and it might have been equally compelling as long as the rooms were the same. The rooms are the stars. That's why they're in the title. Parsons is a good director, and the work he put into the web series clearly shows because instinct alone would not get a 20-year-old this far. He will get better at composition. The centered, wide-angle, black hole sun look of the flashbacks is not compelling, even if it does set up the final shot well, but his pacing and editing rhythms are already right where they need to be. Now we unfortunately need to turn our attention to the other horror movie that has had Gen Z by the broccoli for the past 4 weeks. This one was also made by a young artist who started out online, 26-year-old Curry Barker. But what differentiates his movie Obsession from Backrooms is that it is terrible. And not only terrible, but terrible in ways that correspond to a lot of depressingly familiar trends against which I have already inveighed on these airwaves in tirades that probably add up to an hour or more. My patience with these kinds of blatant, programmatic, incurious horror movies has been worn down to the subfloor. And I was so bummed as I shuffled out of this one that I couldn't face the task of writing up its thousands of blemishes and absences. So instead, I wrote a nasty little stinger about how I didn't want to write about it. Here's a review I'm getting sick of writing. New horror movie by first-time writer-director 20-something visionary Von YouTube has a kinda okay premise, but doesn't have one-tenth the intelligence, patience, curiosity, or craft talent required to squeeze that premise for any of its juice. If a dumb horror movie on this premise had been made in the 80s, it would have been a normal dumb horror movie. But because this one was made in the 2020s as brand content by a glorified influencer who has no idea what movies are, it is instead one of the worst movies of all time. Now we can turn our attention from contemporary horror movies to something far more horrific, contemporary comedies. No, I'm getting into the spirit of comedy by kidding. Comedy may have been the genre that got closest to going all the way down the drain when proper screenwriting ceased, but the following movie is actually pretty good. Sorry to Bother You was like a song by one of those amazing punk bands that always seemed a second away from collapsing into chaos and that derived all its power from a constant flirtation with that collapse. It was a social satire about the black experience of the 21st century workplace, narrow in its political scope, but with such a wild and playful spirit and such a vast toy box of zany story ideas that it became one of the most entertaining comedies of the 20-teens on this force alone. Boots Riley, the writer and director, piled what seemed like an unsafe amount of these zany ideas on his back, but he managed a small miracle with the bundle, not just sustaining but escalating that sense of danger the whole time, new ideas keep coming basically until the end, and against all odds steering it around every trap set for it and bringing it in for a landing on one bent wheel. His new movie, I Love Boosters, does not manage that same kind of stunt pilotry. It's about a trio of young black women, Kiki Palmer, Naomi Ackie, Taylor Page, who subsist in today's brutal retail economy by squatting inside a disused fast food chicken restaurant and boosting clothes from boutiques to resell at a discount. Our main character, Corvette Palmer, who is the only one given any real interiority, dreams of being a designer herself. And as the gang's acts of theft become frequent and daring enough that they find themselves being targeted by a crazy and vengeful designer CEO, a bottle blonde Demi Moore, Corvette discovers that an item in the CEO's new collection was stolen from a design that she, Corvette, had submitted to a contest held by the label the previous year. This is a good start for a piece of brash comic agitprop. The setup confronts one of the retail sector's most irritatingly dishonest tall tales, that there is a shoplifting epidemic cutting into their bottom lines, and that this, and not the wage suppression that retailers all practice for the sake of their shareholders and executives, is the real theft. But Riley hews this premise into a movie extremely roughly. It's nearly as daring as his 2018 masterpiece, and is, no matter what, the funniest and most enjoyable movie I've seen this year so far, but Riley absolutely and unequivocally does lose control of it, such that the third act is spent frantically rushing around to neaten up all the plot connections, and the thematic payoff seems like a bucket of paint poured onto the movie from above. Or, for those who have seen it, a stream of clear fluid sprayed out of a magic life preserver. There isn't just debris left on the floor. There are large pieces of story that never find a home. And the movie's underlying lesson about how socialism is the human race's only hope for any kind of future, the lesson which, as a slapstick propagandist, is the entire reason why Riley made the movie, starts to blur beneath the narrative excesses. But everyone is trying their hand at broad class satire in the movies right now, and in spite of the overripe conditions, Riley has emerged as one of the only artists who is thoughtful and imaginative enough to pull it off. In a time when everyone else is a foot wide of the mark, it feels hugely satisfying to see a satirist who can make any contact at all. The abuses of the wealthy make up a massive and urgently festering social wound right now, such that even a tiny dab of antiseptic ointment is going to give some feeling of relief. Riley has not only done the required reading, and he unfortunately shares his contemporaries' obnoxious overeagerness to prove as much, but he shows enough love for his performers and enough facility with dramatic fundamentals to make the core of the story just firm and anchored enough that the world it takes place in can effectively become the whirligig that it's supposed to be. His other gift, the simpler one, is that he can spin that whirligig faster than just about anyone. And this, as it did in Sorry to Bother You, charges everything with a spirit of unbridled fun, the fun of possibility in film. Everyone making movies today wants to be a teacher. Riley is the only one in the whole bunch who can make school fun. To cite one gag out of the movie's several hundred, it takes conviction to make the lair of the fashion CEO supervillain a condo with a slanted floor, and trust the audience to get that this is a joke about the showy and burdensome counterintuitiveness of high fashion clothes. And it takes a belief in fun to let a whole range of reverse wuxia visual gags play out on that floor, pulling inspiration from everywhere from Chaplin to Sonic the Hedgehog. What's more, if it weren't for these kinds of teasers in Act 1 demonstrating his ability to express ideology in cartoon imagery, Riley wouldn't earn the gleeful cackles that rang out all over my theater when he busted out the situational accelerator device in Act 2, which heightens the internal contradiction of whatever you pointed at. But the deliciousness of these kinds of setups becomes a bit sad when you don't get any proper and satisfying follow-through, and in place of that, you just get more chunklets of loose narrative DNA. The situational accelerator gets you salivating for demonstrations, but not even one of those lives up to the comic potential of this gonzo device. We move swiftly to the machine's alternate deconstruct mode, and that doesn't kick up many diamonds either. As we get into Act 3, the device becomes more of an albatross. By then, it's creating more problems for the movie than delights, especially in the plot. With little time left to go, the stray story elements that initially had seemed like valuable seasoning start to make an oppressive pile. The Chinese factory workers who make the clothes, a demon character played by Lakeith Stanfield with an Italian accent, a Katamari Damacy ball of stressors that only Corvette can see, and a claymation bit about people in skin suits that tries and fails to be this movie's third act Hail Mary of wackiness as the horse people were for Sorry to Bother You. The movie wants to give you a big jazz hands finish like Sorry to Bother You pulled off, but it can't conceal its panting and wheezing. Happily, Kiki Palmer continues to be an S-tier star, while Naomi Ackie and Taylor Page, though not as distinguished as Palmer, including by the story, are also very appealing actresses on the rare occasions that they have good material to work with. Love and high energy carry the movie very far, if not all the way. Riots should commence if Shirley Kurata does not win the Academy Award for Best Costume Design. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.